3, 2, 1, liftoff.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Welcome to a History of the Space Race Podcast. Episode 62, Apollo 8, First Lap to the Moon. Apollo 8 is probably the most underappreciated missions in space race history. I think of it this way. In a typical telling of the space race, the story goes that the Soviet Union achieved almost all of the important firsts. The first satellite, the first man in space, the first woman in space, the first EVA, and so forth. In this typical telling, the United States only achieves the last, albeit most important, first, the first men on the moon. But if we were to rate progress in the space race in terms of firsts, Apollo 8 alone would have meant the United States blew the Soviet Union out of the water. While Apollo 11 will achieve the first landing on the moon, it is Apollo 8 that will pave the way with a series of other firsts. Apollo 8 will see the first time that humans leave the Earth to be within the gravity well of another celestial body. The first time that humans will see the entire planet Earth from space. The first time humans will never experience a night with sunrise and sunsets. The first time humans will be exposed to solar radiation outside of Earth's magnetic field. The first time a Saturn V rocket will carry humans. The first time humans orbited the moon. The first time human eyes set sight on the backside of the moon, and the first time humans saw Earth rise from the moon. In addition to firsts, Apollo 8 will set new records, including a record for the fastest a human has ever traveled and the furthest that humans had ever gone from Earth. The backstory to Apollo 8 is also incredible. The Apollo 8 mission was not something that NASA had originally planned. Rather, it was a mission that NASA found itself having to perform because other equipment was not ready for testing in late 1968. There was also significant reservation about launching the Apollo 8 mission. Apollo 8 would be only the second manned Apollo mission and the first manned mission for the Saturn V rocket. And yet, the Apollo 8 mission profile called for launching humans all the way to the moon on only the second manned mission and on the first manned Saturn V. When the Soviets showed signs that they too were aiming at the moon with their Soyuz 7K-L1 lunar spacecraft, however, NASA's decision to go to the moon solidified, and Apollo 8 was a go. Add on top of all of this drama, the fact that Apollo 8 occurs over Christmas. But now I am getting very far ahead of myself. So let me back up and start this story from the beginning. NASA had sketched out 7 mission types that should be accomplished for landing humans on the moon. NASA lettered these steps A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. Step A was an unmanned test of the Apollo command module. Step B was an unmanned test of the lunar module. Step C was a manned test of the command module in Earth orbit. Step D was a manned test of the command and lunar modules in Earth orbit. Step E would then be a high-altitude mission with both the command and lunar module to test both spacecraft away from Earth. Step F would be a full dress rehearsal to send a command module and lunar module around the moon. And step G would be the actual manned landing on the moon. At this point, Ev brought us up to November 1968 in the space race. And by this time, NASA has completed the first three mission types, steps A, B, and C. Apollo 4 and Apollo 6 were step A missions. Both missions used Saturn V rockets to carry unmanned command modules into Earth orbit. Apollo 5 was a step B mission. Apollo 5 used a Saturn 1B rocket to test an unmanned lunar module in Earth orbit. Apollo 7 was a step C mission. Apollo 7 had launched the first crewed Apollo command module into Earth orbit. So, in the order of the mission types to be completed, step D was next. Step D was a manned test of both the command module and the lunar module in Earth orbit. But here, NASA faced a problem. They did not have a lunar module that was ready for a manned mission. By mid-1968, NASA already knew that it might not be able to complete the Step D mission on time. On June 14, 1968, the lunar module manufacturer, the Grumman Corporation, delivered the LM-3, or Lunar Module 3, to Cape Canaveral. LM-3 was the first lunar module slated for use in a manned mission. But upon inspection after delivery, NASA found that LM-3 contained over 100 manufacturing errors, many of them major. There were corrosion problems, incorrect wire splicing, and failures in the spacecraft's windows. NASA and Grumman would need months to correct the issues, and then re-inspect and retest. This meant that in late 1968, NASA could expect to have on hand two Apollo command modules, but no lunar module. If NASA were to wait for the lunar module before launching the next mission, Apollo 8 would not take place until early 1969. By then, with less than a year before the end of the decade, accomplishing President Kennedy's goal of landing on the moon before 1970 was grim. In light of the predicament, two men at NASA began to push for a new kind of mission to use the Apollo command modules that NASA had on hand. The two men involved in the planning were Christopher Kraft and George Lowe. Both men had become involved with the Apollo mission planning after the Apollo 1 fire. Kraft, as I mentioned in episode 34, was originally the flight director at Houston Mission Control. When it became clear during the Gemini program that NASA would need a rotation of flight directors so that Mission Control could provide 24-hour coverage during a manned mission in space, Kraft became director of flight operations. In practice, however, he continued to serve more like a lead flight director. That is, he still performed the duties of the other flight directors and acted more like a first among equals with the other flight directors. In the aftermath of the Apollo 1 fire, however, he became more involved in management and mission planning, rather than the operations of mission control. The other man, George Lowe, was the deputy director of Houston Mission Control. After the Apollo 1 fire, he was also named head of the Apollo Spacecraft Program Office, also known as ASPO. Before the Apollo 1 fire, the head of the Apollo Spacecraft Program Office was Joseph Shea. But as I mentioned in episode 52, some careless words by Senator Walter Mondale, the future disaster of a presidential candidate, led to Shea's removal from that post and his eventual departure from public service. This led to George Lowe taking over the Apollo Spacecraft Program Office. So, in June 1968, lacking a lunar module, Kraft and Lowe began to consider a crewed high-orbit mission with ZEST, a command module. This would be like the E-type mission, which called for a crewed high-orbit mission with both a command module and a lunar module, except there would be no lunar module in this version of the mission. And pretty soon, high orbit was changed to lunar orbit. There were advantages to such a mission. NASA could learn about spacecraft operations in lunar orbit, such as navigation, communications, and environmental controls. Kraft and Lowe started to refer to this lunar orbital mission as the C-prime mission. C-prime because Step C was the manned test flight of an Apollo command module. But this modified Step C mission, or C-prime, would be going all the way to the moon. Kraft and Lowe began planning the C-prime mission in August 1968. They did so in secret, fearing they could prematurely excite the press, not to mention the astronauts, if news of planning for the first mission to the moon leaked. The first planning meeting occurred on August 14, 1968, with Kraft, Lowe, Deputy Administrator Thomas Paine, and personnel from the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, and the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, as well as personnel from NASA headquarters. The meeting took place at Marshall in Alabama because it was centrally located for all of the other NASA centers involved. To maintain secrecy, this meeting was referred to simply as Sam's budget exercise. The meeting itself took about 3 hours. During the meeting on August 14th, Deputy Administrator Paine played devil's advocate. He pointed out that this mission to the moon would require a Saturn V rocket. It would be the first manned Saturn V mission, and there were questions about whether the Saturn V was man-rated. Recall that at this point, NASA had launched 2 Saturn V rockets, Apollo 4 and Apollo 6. Apollo 4 had gone swimmingly well. Apollo 6, however, suffered a series of problems that would have doomed a mission to the moon. 2 of the 5 J2 engines on the second stage had failed, and the one and only J2 engine on the third stage failed to restart once it was in orbit. There were also some pogo problems during the first stage that, while still technically within tolerances for manned flight, were not something that ground control really wanted during a manned mission. As a result of the Apollo 6 mission, NASA was still considering whether a third unmanned test launch of the Saturn V was necessary. Indeed, George Low's boss, Robert Gilruth, the director of the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, was of the mindset that a third test was necessary. It was therefore problematic to some that they were now talking about launching humans on the next Saturn V mission. Kraft and Low made two main arguments in return. First, they pointed out that if NASA decided that the next Saturn V launch should be manned, then it did not matter how far they sent the astronauts. In other words, once the astronauts were in space, the increase in risk of flying all the way to the moon, as opposed to flying around in Earth orbit, was not that much greater. The main question was really whether NASA was ready to launch humans on the next Saturn V. The Marshall Space Flight Center, the ones who developed the Saturn V rocket, was leaning increasingly in favor of yes, though they had not made an official decision yet. If the Marshall Space Flight Center greenlit the Saturn V for humans, then there was really no reason to hold back going to the moon. We know today, with the benefit of hindsight, that there actually was an appreciable increase in risk of going to the moon as opposed to staying in Earth orbit. We know this because of the events of Apollo 13. Spoiler alert, but peering into the future a little bit, we know during the Apollo 13 mission that an explosion in the service module oxygen tank effectively caused the command module to start dying. The only way that the three astronauts on Apollo 13 were able to make it home was by using the lunar module as a lifeboat until they made their way around the moon and back to Earth. The Apollo 8 mission that Kraft and Low were proposing, however, would not have a lunar module. So if the accident that will happen on Apollo 13 had happened on Apollo 8 instead, Apollo 8's crew almost certainly would not have made it home. The second argument that they made was that Apollo 8 had to be launched by December 1968 if they were to have any chance of meeting President Kennedy's deadline to land on the moon before 1970. If they waited for the lunar module to complete the next step toward landing on the moon, Apollo 8 would not happen until early 1969. Leaving less than a year to complete the other missions and the moon landing. But if they launched Apollo 8 on a lunar orbital mission in December 1968, NASA would gain invaluable experience about operating a spacecraft at lunar distances, and learning more about the environment around the moon before sending a lunar module there. The August 14th meeting ended positively. Not everyone was decidedly in favor of launching Apollo 8 to the moon, but everyone agreed that, with more study, the mission seemed quite feasible. But now the task turned toward convincing NASA leadership that a lunar orbital mission for Apollo 8 was a good idea. And that was not going to be an easy task. The two people who had to be convinced were NASA Administrator James Webb and Director of the Office of Manned Spaceflight, George Miller. Neither man had attended the August 14th meeting in Huntsville, Alabama. Both were in Vienna, Austria at the time, attending meetings at the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. This was the same United Nations Committee that had drafted the Outer Space Treaty that I covered back in episode 51. The task for convincing Webb and Miller fell to their respective deputies, Deputy Administrator Payne and Samuel C. Phillips, Miller's director for the Apollo program. Payne and Phillips sent a cablegram, yes, a cablegram, which is sent via an underwater telegraph cable, because this is still 1968, detailing the proposed mission to Webb and Miller in Vienna. Payne and Phillips had apparently become so supportive of the lunar orbital mission for Apollo 8 that the cablegram suggested that Webb and Miller announced the decision to go to the moon while they were still in meetings at Vienna. Webb and Miller, however, were skeptical. They were aware, as Payne had argued at the August 14th meeting, that the Saturn V rocket had not been cleared for manned flight yet. On top of that, NASA still had not even launched a manned mission in an Apollo command module. Remember, that doesn't happen until Apollo 7 in October 1968, and it was only August when Webb and Miller received this proposal. In this climate, when they had not yet launched a single manned Apollo mission, it seemed like the team was jumping the gun to plan for a manned mission to the moon. Webb declined to make any announcement in Vienna. In fact, he, like his subordinates, was very afraid that the press might catch rumors of a manned mission to the moon and cause unnecessary excitement. As a result, Webb told Payne and Phillips that they could keep planning for a lunar orbital mission, but they should talk about nothing other than an Earth orbital mission. In the end, Webb decided to condition his approval of a lunar orbital mission for Apollo 8 on the outcome of the Apollo 7 mission. Apollo 7 would be the first manned Apollo mission to be conducted in Earth orbit. Its success would tell NASA that the command module was ready to go. But this decision to condition a lunar orbital Apollo 8 mission on the success of Apollo 7 appeared to be driven in part by sheer conservatism. Because while Apollo 7 would confirm that the command module was ready, Apollo 7 would do nothing to address the concerns about the Saturn V, because Apollo 7 was an Earth orbital mission, and only a Saturn 1B rocket would be used. NASA would have no mission to verify that the problems detected with the Saturn V during Apollo 6 had been fixed. Over the course of the next month, however, preparations for a lunar orbital Apollo 8 mission continued in the hopes of eventual approval. The arrival of the command and service modules for Apollo 8 at Cape Canaveral in August 1968 allowed for a checkout of the systems to begin. This command module only required minor work to make ready for the mission. The biggest breakthrough came on September 19, 1968. The Marshall Space Flight Center declared that the issues with the Saturn V had been corrected. It was now cleared for manned flight. But during this same time period, the Soviets were making disturbing moves toward the moon. As I mentioned a few episodes ago in episode 59, the Soviet Union launched Zond 5 on September 15, 1968. Zond 5 was an unmanned Soyuz 7K-L1 circumlunar spacecraft, carrying a host of biological experiments, including live tortoises. Zond 5 made it all the way around the moon and splashed down in the Indian Ocean 6 days later, becoming the first spacecraft to be recovered after a journey to the moon. The success of the Zond 5 mission seemed to impress upon NASA that they were still in a race against the Soviets, and they needed to keep pushing. For NASA, all eyes then turned to the launch of Apollo 7. That mission started on October 11, 1968, and ended 11 days later on October 22nd. As I covered in the last episode, that mission turned out to be a success, besides the mild mutiny led by the astronauts. Shortly after Apollo 7, on November 7, 1968, a review board certified to Deputy Administrator Payne that the Apollo Command Module, the Saturn V rocket, the launch complexes, the communications networks, and the spacesuits were all ready for a manned mission to the moon. So now the ball was back in the court of NASA management. Should Apollo 8 be a lunar orbital mission or not? As NASA management sat around deciding in early November 1968, the Soviet Union reminded the Americans once again that they were still in a race to the moon. On November 10, 1968, the Soviet Union launched Zond 6 from the Baikonur Cosmodrome. Zond 6 was the launch of the third unmanned circumlunar Soyuz 7K-L1 spacecraft. As with the Zond 5, which launched only 3 months earlier in September 1968, Zond 6 carried a host of biological experiments. Zond 6 made it all the way to the moon, where it returned high-resolution photos of the lunar surface. As with previous L1 missions, the Zond 6 L1 had some difficulties with its automated attitude control system. Nevertheless, there were no critical issues until Zond 6 started to make its way home. On the way back to Earth, sensors detected a loss in cabin pressure. The extent of the problem was not fully understood, and the Soviets hoped to bring Zond 6 back home safely. The spacecraft's critical systems remained intact, and Zond 6 maneuvered to make the first successful guided re-entry into the atmosphere by an L1 spacecraft. Zond 6 hit the correct re-entry corridor so that it skipped once on the atmosphere, slowing its velocity, before dipping back in for a re-entry at a slower speed. Amazingly, the spacecraft, after making a 400,000-kilometer journey to the moon and back, landed only 16 kilometers away from the Baikonur Cosmodrome, where it had taken off. Landed, though, was not really the right word. Zond 6 kind of crashed into the ground after the parachute system was prematurely released. A subsequent investigation revealed that the depressurization inside the spacecraft cabin was nearly complete. The depressurization had thrown off sensors, causing the spacecraft to prematurely release its parachute. The depressurization had also killed all of the biological payloads. If the mission had been crewed, the cosmonauts on board likely would have died. For the Soviet Union, the outcome of the Zond 6 mission began to force recognition of an impending public relations disaster. The United States was definitely going to get to the moon before they were. And this did not simply mean a landing on the moon. It also meant sending humans into the vicinity of the moon in a circumlunar or lunar orbital flight. Remember that the Soviet Union had emphasized a manned circumlunar mission. But the United States was now poised to beat the Soviet Union even in this more limited goal. Even though NASA was trying to keep quiet rumors that Apollo 8 might be sent to the moon, Western media was already making this speculation. In response to the speculation, and the inevitable questions about what the Soviet Union was doing in the space race, the Soviets began to publicly distance themselves from the idea of sending humans to the moon. Soviet spokesmen began to say that the moon was not on the Soviet Union's agenda. The coincidental launch of the Earth Orbital Soyuz 3 mission in late October 1968 appeared to give credence to the Soviet Union's claims that they were not interested in the moon. This, of course, was wrong. The Soviet Union was simply bracing itself for the coming public relations disaster when the United States got to the moon first. NASA was also ignoring Soviet claims that they were not aiming for the moon. On November 11, 1968, the day after the Soviet Union launched Zond 6 to the moon, Miller officially recommended that Apollo 8 be sent into lunar orbit. On November 18, 1968, the day after Zond 6 returned to Earth, Deputy Administrator Thomas Paine approved. The decision to go to the moon for Apollo 8 had fallen to Paine because he had become NASA's acting administrator after James Webb retired from NASA in October 1968. While the Zond 6 mission contributed to NASA confirming its decision to go to the moon on Apollo 8, Zond 6 caused the Soviet Union to steel itself for defeat. Before the Zond 6 mission, the Soviet Union still had hopes of launching a manned circumlunar flight before the United States. Vasily Mishin had been ordered to conduct 4 unmanned L-1 missions before launching a manned flight. Before Zond 6, he had already launched 2, Zond 4 in March 1968 that flew to a lunar distance, and Zond 5 in September 1968 that flew to the moon and back. If Zond 6, launched in November 1968, had been successful, the Soviet Union could have skipped 1 unmanned mission and proceeded with a manned mission in December 1968. The positioning of the Earth and the Moon had also given the Soviet Union an advantage. The December launch window to the Moon from the Soviet Union would be open from December 8th to December 10th, 1968. For the United States, which was now aiming to launch Apollo 8 to the moon in December, the launch window would not open until December 21st. So, if Zond 6 had been a success, the Soviet Union could have attempted a manned mission to the moon first. But Zond 6 was not a success. It had depressurized and then crashed into the ground. After Zond 6, Vasily Mishin decided to postpone a crewed L-1 mission. He needed at least 1 more unmanned launch. He would also need to skip the December launch window to figure out what had gone wrong with the L-1 spacecraft this time, meaning the earliest that the next unmanned flight could take place was January 1969. The earliest that a crewed mission could take place was probably April 1969. By then, NASA would have long completed the Apollo 8 mission, scheduled for December 1968. Basically, Mission realized after Zond 6 that there was no winning the race to the moon. On December 21st, 1968, NASA launched Apollo 8 as planned. Aboard Apollo 8 were astronauts Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders. During launch, the astronauts were able to confirm that the concerns with the Saturn V rocket had indeed been addressed. The level of pogo was very tolerable, and during the firing of the first stage, the astronauts experienced no more than 4 Gs. The third stage of the rocket, the S-4B, eventually put Apollo 8 in Earth orbit. At 10:17 a.m. in Eastern Standard Time, and less than 2.5 hours into the mission, astronaut Mike Collins, acting as the capsule communicator, gave one of the most historic commands from Houston Mission Control. What you heard Collins saying was, "You are go for TLI. TLI is Translunar Injection. This was the command to fire up the S-4B to push the command module on a trajectory toward the moon. The command was historic for numerous reasons. This maneuver would be the first ever to send humans to another celestial body. It would also accelerate Borman, Lovell, and Anders to speeds that no human had ever traveled before, about 10,800 meters a second. The TLI burn actually wouldn't happen for about another 4 minutes after the order came from Mission Control. After completing the burn, the command and service modules separated from the S-4B stage, ending the Saturn V rocket's role in the mission. At this point, the crew suffered from a slight medical problem. The problem began when Borman, Lovell, and Anders began taking off their pressure suits. Mission rules allowed them to do this now that they had separated from the S-4B, and removing the pressure suits would allow them to move more freely in the command module. But after they took off the pressure suits, each of them felt motion sickness, likely brought on by their rapid movements. Borman was hit the worst. Borman's situation was complicated because he may have also had the stomach flu at the time. On top of this, he had taken some medication to help sleep. You see, Borman had been allotted the first sleep period, and because of the delays in the departure and the separation from the S-4B, they were now entering his allotted sleep period. Worried that he wouldn't be able to fall asleep fast enough, he had decided to take some sleeping pills. Unfortunately, he also had some sort of allergic reaction to those pills. When he woke up, he vomited. Then he had to go to the bathroom. There was a loose stool situation, which the waste management system barely contained. The crew then called for the flight surgeon on the ground, but after this, Borman started to feel better. During the journey to the moon, the crew of Apollo 8 made two television broadcasts back home. They even tried to show the Earth by pointing the camera at the window, but it didn't quite work due to fogging and lensing. On December 23rd, 1968, 2 days into the journey, Apollo 8 made history. Apollo 8 made it about 326,400 kilometers away from the Earth, and was about 62,600 kilometers away from the Moon. At this point, the instruments on the spacecraft showed that Apollo 8's velocity, which had been slowing ever since the TLI maneuver from the S-4B rocket stage, counted down to 1,218 meters per second. Then the spacecraft started accelerating again, meaning Apollo 8 had finally entered the Moon's gravitational field. This moment was like a skateboarder who rides up a ramp, losing speed as he goes up, before coming back down on the other side of the ramp, gaining speed again as gravity pulls him back down. After this historic moment, the crew needed to fire the Apollo 8's service module engine for another maneuver, lunar orbital insertion. The plan was to fire the service module's engine in the direction of travel, to slow Apollo 8 down so that it would be more firmly captured by the Moon's gravitational field, and Apollo 8 would come within about 119 kilometers of the lunar surface. An irony was that during this maneuver, and really during the entire trip to the Moon, the Apollo 8 crew could not actually see the Moon. Remember that given the distance that needs to be traveled, Apollo 8 is not pointed at the Moon at launch. Rather, Apollo 8 was set on a course to intersect with a point in space where the Moon will be in a few days' time. So the Moon was, relatively speaking, coming to them from the side, rather than being in front of them and visible from the windows during the journey. On top of that, during the lunar orbital insertion maneuver, the spacecraft had to fly backwards. The crew had to take it on faith that ground control was right, and they were eventually to come into contact with the Moon. At about 69 hours into the mission, Apollo 8 would start to go behind the Moon. As a result, ground control alerted the Apollo 8 crew that a loss of signal, or LOS, was about to happen soon, and wished the crew good luck. This was another critical moment in the Apollo 8 mission. Up to now, Apollo 8 had been in virtually constant contact with the ground. But at exactly 68 hours, 48 minutes, and 45 seconds into the mission, Apollo 8 slipped behind the Moon and lost all contact with Earth. Borman, Lovell, and Anders were now the most isolated human beings in existence. As Apollo 8 rounded the dark side of the Moon, the astronauts finally set eyes on the Moon for the first time since their launch. They did not have much time to enjoy the scene, however. They needed to perform a second burn to finish placing Apollo 8 in lunar orbit. For about 4 minutes, the service module engine fired, eventually putting them in an elliptical orbit about 312 kilometers by 111 kilometers above the Moon. Once Apollo 8 emerged from the other side of the Moon and communications with the ground was restored, the astronauts confirmed that the burn had been successful. It was Christmas Eve, 1968, and the first humans were now in lunar orbit. At this point, Lovell provided the first description of the moon by human eyes from lunar orbit. Apollo 8 stayed in lunar orbit for about a day, circling the moon 10 times. During this stay, human eyes set sight upon the dark side of the moon for the first time. Human eyes saw Earth rise from the moon for the first time. On the ninth orbit, the crew conducted a television broadcast on Christmas Day. To commemorate the occasion, the crew gave a prayer and read from the book of Genesis.
We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. But God called the light day,
And the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. Let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day.
God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called these seas. God saw that it was good. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
After the 10th orbit, it was time for Apollo 8 to go home. 3 days and 17 hours into the mission, the service module engine fired once again to accelerate the crew back to Earth. During the journey home, ground control read the news to the crew. So as they came home, Borman, Lovell, and Anders heard about the tremendous impact their journey to the moon had had on the world. Across the world, newspapers remarked on humanity's first trip to another celestial body. Apollo 8's trajectory back to Earth was spot on. They were on track to hit the atmosphere at the perfect re-entry corridor, and then fly over northeast China before coming down in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. As Apollo 8 got closer and closer to Earth and started re-entering the atmosphere, Mission Control remarked on just how perfect the re-entry angle was. They joked that Apollo 8 was so on target that it might actually come straight down on the aircraft carrier, the USS Yorktown, that was there to pick them up. And then, as Apollo 8 got closer, it stopped becoming a joke. Orders were given for the recovery fleet to steam about a dozen kilometers away to make sure that Apollo 8 did not come down right on their heads. On December 27th, 1968, 6 days after the mission began, Apollo 8 splashed down in the Pacific Ocean. After splashdown, the spacecraft flipped over on its nose until the airbags inflated to flip it back upright. Apollo 8 had landed in the dark, so the recovery team waited 45 minutes until daylight broke, and then a helicopter from the USS Yorktown picked them up. So ended one of the most important space missions in human history. And next time, I'll talk about the Soviet Union's response to Apollo 8.